What it there, babe? Right in the old mitt,
Lex cried, and Gennaro threw the ball to her. She threw it back so hard that his hands stung.
Take it easy. I don't have a glove. You wimp,
she said contemptuously. Annoyed, he fired the ball at her and heard it smack in the leather.
Now that's more like it, she said.
Standing by the dinosaur, Gennaro continued to play catch as he talked to Malcolm. How does this sick dinosaur fit into your theory?
It's predicted, Malcolm said.
Gennaro shook his head.
Is anything not predicted by your theory?
Look, Malcolm said, it's nothing to do with me. It's chaos theory. But I notice nobody is willing to listen to the consequences of the mathematics because they imply very large consequences for human life. Much larger than Heisenberg's principle or Gödel's theorem, which everybody rattles on about. Those are actually rather academic considerations, philosophical considerations. But chaos theory concerns everyday life. Do you know why computers were first built?
No, Gennaro said.
Burn it in there,
Lex yelled. Computers were built in the late 1940s because mathematicians like John von Neumann thought that if you had a computer, a machine to handle a lot of variables simultaneously, you would be able to predict the weather. Weather would finally fall to human understanding, and men believed that dream for the next 40 years. They believed that prediction was just a function of keeping track of things. If you knew enough, you could predict anything. That's been a cherished scientific belief since Newton.
And?
Chaos theory throws it right out the window. It says that you can never predict certain phenomena at all. You can never predict the weather more than a few days away. All the money that has been spent on long-range forecasting, about $500 million in the last few decades, is money wasted. It's a fool's errand. It's as pointless as trying to turn lead into gold. We look back at the alchemists and laugh at what they were trying to do, but future generations will laugh at us the same way. We've tried the impossible and spent a lot of money doing it. Because, in fact, there are great categories of phenomena that are inherently unpredictable.
Chaos says that?
Yes. And it is astonishing how few people care to hear it, Malcolm said. I gave all this information to Hammond long before he broke ground on this place. You're going to engineer a bunch of prehistoric animals and set them on an island? Fine. A lovely dream. Charming. But it won't go as planned. It is inherently unpredictable, just as the weather is.
You told him this?
Gennaro said.
Yes.
I also told him where the deviations would occur. Obviously, the fitness of the animals to the environment was one area. This stegosaur is 100 million years old. It isn't adapted to our world. The air is different, the solar radiation is different, the land is different, the insects are different, the sounds are different, the vegetation is different, everything is different. The oxygen content is decreased. This poor animal's like a human being at 10,000 feet altitude. Listen to him wheezing.
And the other areas?
Broadly speaking, the ability of the park to control the spread of life forms, because the history of evolution is that life escapes all barriers. Life breaks free. Life expands to new territories. Painfully, perhaps even dangerously, but life finds a way. Malcolm shook his head.
I don't mean to be philosophical, but there it is.
Gennaro looked over. Ellie and Grant were across the field, waving their arms and shouting.
Did you get my coke? Dennis Nedry asked as Muldoon came back into the control room.
Muldoon didn't bother to answer. He went directly to the monitor and looked at what was happening. Over the radio, we heard Harding's voice saying,
Estego, finally, handle on now.
What's that about? Muldoon said.
They're down by the South Point, Arnold said. That's why they're breaking up a little. I'll switch them to another channel. But they found out what's wrong with the Stegos, eating some kind of berry.
Hammond nodded.
I knew we'd solve that sooner or later, he said.
It's not very impressive, Gennaro said. He held the white fragment, no larger than a postage stamp, up on his fingertip in the fading light.
You sure about this, Alan?
Absolutely sure, Grant said. What gives it away is the patterning on the interior surface, the interior curve. Turn it over and you will notice a faint pattern of raised lines. making roughly triangular shapes.
Yes, I see them.
Well, I've dug out two eggs with patterns like that at my site in Montana.
You're saying this is a piece of dinosaur eggshell?
Absolutely, Grant said. Harding shook his head. These dinosaurs can't breed.
Evidently they can, Gennaro said.
That must be a bird egg, Harding said. We have literally dozens of species on the island.
Grant shook his head. Look at the curvature. The shell is almost flat. That's from a very big egg.
And notice the thickness of the shell. Unless you have ostriches on this island, it's a dinosaur egg.
But they can't possibly breed, Harding insisted. All the animals are female.
All I know, Grant said, is that this is a dinosaur egg.
Malcolm said, Can you tell the species?
Yes, Grant said. It's a velociraptor egg.
Control.
Absolutely absurd, Hammond said in the control room, listening to the report over the radio. It must be a bird egg. That's all it can be.
The radio crackled. He heard Malcolm's voice.
Let's do a little test, shall we? Ask Mr. Arnold to run one of his computer tallies.
Now?
Yes, right now. I understand you can transmit it to the screen in Dr. Harding's car. Do that, too, will you?
No problem, Arnold said.
A moment later, the screen in the control room printed out the same list as before of the total animal numbers in the park. There was no change in the figures.
I hope you're satisfied, Hammond said. Are you receiving it down there on your screen?
We see it, Malcolm said.
Everything accounted for, as always.
He couldn't keep the satisfaction out of his voice.
Now then, Malcolm said, can you have the computer search for a different number of animals?
Like what? Arnold said.
Try 239.
Just a minute, Arnold said, frowning.
A moment later, the screen printed the list again. Above the list, the total number of animals was now given as 239. At the bottom of the list, the totals now read, Expected animals, 238. Found animals, 239. The list itself was unchanged, except for the number of found procompsognathids.
Hammond sat forward. What the hell is that? We picked up another compy. From where?
I don't know.
The radio crackled.
Now then, can you ask the computer to search for, let us say, 300 animals?
What is he talking about? Hammond said, his voice rising. 300 animals? What's he talking about? Just a minute, Arnold said. That'll take a few minutes.
He pushed buttons on the screen. The first line of the totals appeared. Total animals, 239.
I don't understand what he's driving at, Hammond said. I'm afraid I do, Arnold said.
He watched the screen. The numbers on the first line were clicking. Total animals, 244.
244? Hammond said. What's going on?
The computer is counting the animals in the park, Wu said. All the animals.
I thought that's what it always did.
He spun.
Nedry, have you screwed up again?
No,
Nedry said, looking up from his console.
Computer allows the operator to enter an expected number of animals in order to make the counting process faster, but it's a convenience, not a flaw.
He's right, Arnold said. We just always use the base count of 238 because we assumed there couldn't be more.
Total animals, 262.
Wait a minute, Hammond said. These animals can't breed. The computer must be counting field mice or something.
I think so, too, Arnold said. It's almost certainly an error in the visual tracking. But we'll know soon enough.
Hammond turned to Wu.
They can't breed, can they?
No, Wu said. Total animals, 270.
Where are they coming from?
Arnold said. Damned if I know, Wu said. They watched the numbers climb. Total animals, 283. Over the radio, they heard Gennaro say,
Holy shit, how much more?
And they heard the girl say,
I'm getting hungry. When are we going home?
Pretty soon, Lex. On the screen, there was a flashing error message. Error, search parameters, 300 animals not found.
An error, Hammond said, nodding. I thought so. I had the feeling all along there must be an error.
But a moment later, the screen printed, Total animals, 292. Tyrannosaurs expected, 2. Found, 2. Version 4.1. Myosaurs expected, 21. Found, 22. Version unknown. Stegosaurs expected, 4. Found, 4. Version 3.9. Triceratops expected, 8. Found, 8. Version 3.1. Procomp sognathids expected, 49. Found, 65. Version unknown. Othnelia expected, 16. Found, 23. Version unknown. Velociraptors expected, 8. Found, 37. Version unknown. Apatosaurs expected, 17. Found, 17. Version 3.1. Hadrosaurs expected, 11. Found, 11. Version 3.1. Dilophosaurs expected, 7. Found, 7. Version 4.3. Pterosaurs expected, 6. Found, 6. Version 4.3. Hypsilophodontids expected, 33. Found, 34. Version unknown. Euplocephalids expected, 16. Found, 16. Version 4.0. Styracosaurs expected, 18. Found, 18. Version 3.9. Microceratops expected, 22. Found, 22. Version 4.1. Total expected, 238. Total found, 292. The radio crackled. Now you see the flaw in your procedures, Malcolm said. You only tracked the expected number of dinosaurs. You were worried about losing animals, and your procedures were designed to advise you instantly if you had less than the expected number. But that wasn't the problem. The problem was you had more than the expected number. Christ, Arnold said. There can't be more, Wu said. We know how many we've released. There can't be more than that. Afraid so, Henry, Malcolm said. They're breeding. No! Even if you don't accept Grant's eggshell, you can prove it with your own data. Take a look at the Compy height graph. Arnold will put it up for you. Arnold did so, and they saw the same smooth single curve as before, the heights peaking at 33 and 34 centimeters. Notice anything about it? Malcolm said. It's a Poisson distribution, Wu said. Normal curve. But didn't you say you introduced the Compies in 3 batches at 6-month intervals? Yes. Then you should get a graph with peaks for each of the 3 separate batches that were introduced, Malcolm said, tapping the keyboard. Like this. A new graph appeared showing an uneven curve with 3 peaks at 26, 33, and 38 centimeters. But you didn't get this graph, Malcolm said. The graph you actually got is a graph of a breeding population. Your compies are breeding. Wu shook his head. I don't see how. They're breeding, and so are the Othnelia, the Myosaurs, the Hypsies, and the Velociraptors. Christ, Muldoon said. There are raptors free in the park. Well, it's not that bad, Hammond said, looking at the screen. We have increases in just 3 categories. Well, 5 categories. Very small increases in 2 of them. What are you talking about? Wu said loudly. Don't you know what this means? Of course I know what this means, Henry, Hammond said. It means you screwed up. Absolutely not. You've got breeding dinosaurs out there, Henry.
But they're all female, Wu said. It's impossible. There must be a mistake. And look at the numbers. A small increase in the big animals, the Myosaurs and the Hypsies, and big increases in the number of small animals. It just doesn't make sense. It must be a mistake.
The radio clicked. Actually, not, Grant said. I think these numbers confirm that breeding is taking place in 7 different sites around the island. Breeding sites. The sky was growing darker. Thunder rumbled in the distance. Grant and the others leaned in the doors of the jeep, staring at the screen on the dashboard.
Breeding sites? Wu said over the radio.
Nests, Grant said. Assuming the average clutches 8 to 12 hatching eggs, these data would indicate the compies have 2 nests. The raptors have 2 nests, the Othis have 1 nest, and the Hypsies and the Mayas have 1 nest each.
Where are these nests?
We'll have to find them, Grant said. Dinosaurs build their nests in secluded places. But why are there so few big animals, Wu said. If there is a Maya nest of 8 to 12 eggs, there should be 8 to 12 new Mayas, not just one.
That's right, Grant said. Except that the raptors and the compies that are loose in the park are probably eating the eggs of the bigger animals, and perhaps eating the newly hatched young as well.
But we've never seen that, Arnold said over the radio.
Raptors are nocturnal, he said. Is anyone watching the park at night?
There was a long silence. I didn't think so, Grant said.
It still doesn't make sense, Wu said. You can't support 50 additional animals on a couple of nests of eggs.
No, Grant said. I assume they are eating something else as well. Perhaps small rodents, mice and rats. There was another silence.
Let me guess, Grant said. When you first came to the island, you had a problem with rats. But as time passed, the problem faded away.
Yes, that's true.
And you never thought to investigate why?
Well, we just assumed, Arnold said.
Look, Wu said, the fact remains all the animals are female. They can't breed.
Grant had been thinking about that. He had recently learned of an intriguing West German study that he suspected held the answer.
When you made your dinosaur DNA, Grant said, you were working with fragmentary pieces, is that right?
Yes, Wu said.
In order to make a complete strand, were you ever required to include DNA fragments from other species?
Occasionally, yes, Wu said.
It's the only way to accomplish the job. Sometimes we included avian DNA from a variety of birds, and sometimes reptilian DNA.
Any amphibian DNA, specifically frog DNA?
Possibly, I'd have to check.
Check, Grant said. I think you'll find that holds the answer.
Malcolm said, frog DNA? Why frog DNA?
Gennaro said impatiently, listen, this is all very intriguing, but we're forgetting the main question. Have any animals gotten off the island?
Grant said, we can't tell from these data.
Then how are we going to find out?
There's only one way I know, Grant said. We'll have to find the individual dinosaur nests, inspect them, and count the remaining egg fragments. From that, we may be able to determine how many animals were originally hatched, and we can begin to assess whether any are missing.
Malcolm said, even so, you won't know if the missing animals are killed or dead from natural causes, or whether they have left the island.
No, Grant said, but it's a start. And I think we can get more information from an intensive look at the population graphs.
How are we going to find these nests?
Actually, Grant said, I think the computer will be able to help us with that.
Can we go back now? Lex said. I'm hungry.
Yes, let's go, Grant said, smiling at her. You've been very patient.
You'll be able to eat in about 20 minutes, Ed Regis said, starting toward the two land cruisers.
I'll stay for a while, Ellie said, and get photos of the stego with Dr. Harding's camera. Those vesicles in the mouth will have cleared up by tomorrow.
I want to get back, Grant said. I'll go with the kids.
I will too, Malcolm said.
I think I'll stay, Gennaro said, and go back with Harding in his jeep with Dr. Sattler.
Fine, let's go.
They started walking. Malcolm said,
why exactly is our lawyer staying?
Grant shrugged. I think it might have something to do with Dr. Sattler.
Really? The shorts, you think?
It's happened before, Grant said.
When they came to the land cruisers, Tim said, I want to ride in the front one this time with Dr. Grant.
Malcolm said, unfortunately, Dr. Grant and I need to talk.
I'll just sit and listen. I won't say anything, Tim said.
It's a private conversation, Malcolm said.
Tell you what, Tim, Ed Regis said. Let them sit in the rear car by themselves. We'll sit in the front car, and you can use the night vision goggles. Have you ever used night vision goggles, Tim? They're goggles with very sensitive CCDs that allow you to see in the dark.
Neat, he said,
and moved toward the first car.
Hey, Lex said, I want to use it too.
No, Tim said.
No fair, no fair. You get to do everything, Timmy.
Ed Regis watched them go and said to Grant, I can see what the ride back is going to be like. Grant and Malcolm climbed into the second car. A few raindrops spattered the windshield.
Let's get going, Ed Regis said. I'm about ready for dinner, and I could do with a nice banana daiquiri.
What do you say, folks? Daiquiri sound good? He pounded the metal panel of the car. "See you back at camp," he said. And he started running toward the first car and climbed aboard. A red light on the dashboard blinked. With a soft electric whir, the Land Cruisers started off. Driving back in the fading light, Malcolm seemed oddly subdued. Grant said, "You must feel vindicated about your theory. As a matter of fact, I'm feeling a bit of dread. I suspect we are at a very dangerous point." "Why?"
"Intuition."
"Do mathematicians believe in intuition?"
"Absolutely. Very important intuition. Actually, I was thinking of fractals," Malcolm said. "Do you know about fractals?"
Grant shook his head. "Not really, no."
"Fractals are a kind of geometry associated with a man named Mandelbrot. Unlike ordinary Euclidean geometry that everybody learns in school, squares and cubes and spheres, fractal geometry appears to describe real objects in the natural world. Mountains and clouds are fractal shapes. So fractals are probably related to reality, somehow." "Well, Mandelbrot found a remarkable thing with his geometric tools. He found that things looked almost identical at different scales."
"At different scales?" Grant said.
"For example," Malcolm said, "a big mountain seen from far away has a certain rugged mountain shape. If you get closer and examine a small peak of the big mountain, it will have the same mountain shape. In fact, you can go all the way down the scale to a tiny speck of rock seen under a microscope. It will have the same basic fractal shape as the big mountain."
"I don't really see why this is worrying you," Grant said. He yawned. He smelled the sulfur fumes of the volcanic steam. They were coming now to the section of road that ran near the coastline, overlooking the beach and the ocean.
"It's a way of looking at things," Malcolm said. "Mandelbrot found a sameness from the smallest to the largest. And this sameness of scale also occurs for events."
"Events?"
"Consider cotton prices," Malcolm said. "There are good records of cotton prices going back more than 100 years. When you study fluctuations in cotton prices, you find that the graph of price fluctuations in the course of a day looks basically like the graph for a week, which looks basically like the graph for a year or for 10 years. And that's how things are. A day is like a whole life. You start out doing one thing, but end up doing something else. Plan to run an errand, but never get there. And at the end of your life, your whole existence has that same haphazard quality, too. Your whole life has the same shape as a single day."
"I guess it's one way to look at things," Grant said.
"No," Malcolm said, "it's the only way to look at things. At least the only way that is true to reality. You see, the fractal idea of sameness carries within it an aspect of recursion, a kind of doubling back on itself, which means that events are unpredictable, that they can change suddenly and without warning."
"Okay. But we have soothed ourselves into imagining sudden change as something that happens outside the normal order of things, an accident like a car crash, or beyond our control like a fatal illness. We do not conceive of sudden, radical, irrational change as built into the very fabric of existence, yet it is. And chaos theory teaches us," Malcolm said, "that straight linearity, which we have come to take for granted in everything from physics to fiction, simply does not exist. Linearity is an artificial way of viewing the world. Real life isn't a series of interconnected events occurring one after another like beads strung on a necklace. Life is actually a series of encounters in which one event may change those that follow in a wholly unpredictable, even devastating way." Malcolm sat back in his seat, looking toward the other Land Cruiser a few yards ahead. "That's a deep truth about the structure of our universe. But for some reason, we insist on behaving as if it were not true." At that moment, the cars jolted to a stop.
"What's happened?" Grant said.
Up ahead, they saw the kids in the car pointing toward the ocean. Offshore, beneath lowering clouds, Grant saw the dark outline of the supply boat making its way back toward Punta Arenas.
"Why have we stopped?" Malcolm said.
Grant turned on the radio and heard the girl saying excitedly,
"Look there, Timmy! You see it? It's there!"
Malcolm squinted at the boat.
"They talking about the boat?"
"Apparently." Ed Regis climbed out of the front car and came running back to their window.
I'm sorry, he said, but the kids are all worked up. Do you have binoculars here? For what? The little girl says she sees something on the boat, some kind of animal, Regis said. Grant grabbed the binoculars and rested his elbows on the window ledge of the Land Cruiser. He scanned the long shape of the supply ship. It was so dark it was almost a silhouette. As he watched, the ship's running lights came on, brilliant in the dark purple twilight. Do you see anything? Regis said. No, Grant said.
They're low down, Lex said over the radio. Look low down.
Grant tilted the binoculars down, scanning the hull just above the waterline. The supply ship was broad-beamed with a splash flange that ran the length of the ship, but it was quite dark now, and he could hardly make out details. No, nothing.
I can see them, Lex said impatiently. Near the back, look near the back.
How can she see anything in this light? Malcolm said. Kids can see, Grant said. They've got visual acuity we forgot we ever had. He swung the binoculars toward the stern, moving them slowly, and suddenly he saw the animals. They were playing, darting among the silhouetted stern structures. He could see them only briefly, but even in the fading light he could tell that they were upright animals, about 2 feet tall, standing with stiff, balancing tails.
You see them now?
Lex said. I see them, he said.
What are they?
They're raptors, Grant said. At least two, maybe more, juveniles. Jesus, Ed Regis said. That boat's going to the mainland. Malcolm shrugged. Don't get excited. Just call the control room and tell them to recall the boat. Ed Regis reached in and grabbed the radio from the dashboard. They heard hissing static and clicks as he rapidly changed channels. There's something wrong with this one, he said. It's not working. He ran off to the first Land Cruiser. They saw him duck into it. Then he looked back at them. There's something wrong with both the radios, he said. I can't raise the control room. Then let's get going, Grant said. In the control room, Muldoon stood before the big windows that overlooked the park. At 7 o'clock, the quartz floodlights came on all over the island, turning the landscape into a glowing jewel stretching away to the south. This was his favorite moment of the day. He heard the crackle of static from the radios. The Land Cruisers have started again, Arnold said. They're on their way home.
But why did they stop? Hammond said. And why can't we talk to them?
I don't know, Arnold said. Maybe they turned off the radios in the cars.
Probably the storm, Muldoon said. Interference from the storm. They'll be here in 20 minutes, Hammond said. You better call down and make sure the dining room is ready for them. Those kids are going to be hungry.
Arnold picked up the phone and heard a steady, monotonous hiss.
What's this? What's going on?
Jesus, hang that up, Nedry said. You'll screw up the data stream.
You've taken all the phone lines, even the internal ones?
I've taken all the lines that communicate outside, Nedry said, but your internal lines should still work.
Arnold punched console buttons one after another. He heard nothing but hissing on all the lines.
Looks like you've got them all.
Sorry about that, Nedry said. I'll clear a couple for you at the end of the next transmission, in about 15 minutes.
He yawned. Looks like a long weekend for me. I guess I'll go get that Coke now.
He picked up his shoulder bag and headed for the door.
Don't touch my console, okay?
The door closed.
What a slob, Hammond said.
Yeah, Arnold said, but I guess he knows what he's doing.
Along the side of the road, clouds of volcanic steam misted rainbows in the bright quartz lights. Grant said into the radio, "How long does it take the ship to reach the mainland?"
18 hours, Ed Regis said, "more or less. It's pretty reliable."
He glanced at his watch.
"It should arrive around 11 tomorrow morning."
Grant frowned.
"You still can't talk to the control room?"
"Not so far."
"How about Harding? Can you reach him?"
"No, I've tried. He may have his radio turned off."
Malcolm was shaking his head.
"So we're the only ones who know about the animals on the ship."
"I'm trying to raise somebody," Ed Regis said. "I mean, Christ, we don't want those animals on the mainland."
"How long until we get back to the base?"
"From here, another 16-17 minutes, Ed Regis said.
At night, the whole road was illuminated by big floodlights. It felt to Grant as if they were driving through a bright green tunnel of leaves. Large raindrops spattered the windshield.
Grant felt the Land Cruiser slow, then stop. Now what?
Lex said, I don't want to stop. Why do we stop?
And then suddenly, all the floodlights went out. The road was plunged into darkness. Lex said,
Hey!
Probably just a power outage or something, Ed Regis said. I'm sure the lights will be on in a minute.
What the hell?
Arnold said, staring at his monitors. What happened? Muldoon said. You lose power?
Yeah, but only power on the perimeter. Everything in this building's working fine. But outside in the park, the power is gone. Lights, TV cameras, everything.
His remote video monitors had gone black.
Now what about the two Land Cruisers? Stopped somewhere around the Tyrannosaur paddock.
Well, Muldoon said, call maintenance and let's get the power back on. Arnold picked up one of his phones and heard hissing, Nedry's computers talking to each other.
No phones, that damn Nedry.
Nedry? Where the hell is he? Dennis Nedry pushed open the door marked fertilization. With the perimeter power out, all the security card locks were disarmed. Every door in the building opened with a touch. The problems with the security system were high on Jurassic Park's bug list. Nedry wondered if anybody ever imagined that it wasn't a bug, that Nedry had programmed it that way. He had built in a classic trap door. Few programmers of large computer systems could resist the temptation to leave themselves a secret entrance. Partly it was common sense. If inept users locked up the system and then called you for help, you always had a way to get in and repair the mess. And partly it was a kind of signature. Kilroy was here. And partly it was insurance for the future. Nedry was annoyed with the Jurassic Park project. Late in the schedule, InGen had demanded extensive modifications to the system, but hadn't been willing to pay for them, arguing they should be included under the original contract. Lawsuits were threatened. Letters were written to Nedry's other clients, implying that Nedry was unreliable. It was blackmail. And in the end, Nedry had been forced to eat his overages on Jurassic Park and to make the changes that Hammond wanted. But later, when he was approached by Lewis Dodgson at Biosyn, Nedry was ready to listen, and able to say that he could indeed get past Jurassic Park security. He could get into any room, any system, anywhere in the park, because he had programmed it that way, just in case. He entered the fertilization room. The lab was deserted. As he had anticipated, all the staff was at dinner. Nedry unzipped his shoulder bag and removed the can of Gillette shaving cream. He unscrewed the base and saw the interior was divided into a series of cylindrical slots. He pulled on a pair of heavy insulated gloves and opened the walk-in freezer marked Contents Viable, Biological, Maintain Minus 10 Degrees Centigrade Minimum. The freezer was the size of a small closet, with shelves from floor to ceiling. Most of the shelves contained reagents and liquids in plastic sacks. To one side, he saw a smaller nitrogen cold box with a heavy ceramic door. He opened it, and a rack of small tubes slid out in a cloud of white liquid nitrogen smoke. The embryos were arranged by species: Stegosaurus, Apatosaurus, Hadrosaurus, Tyrannosaurus. Each embryo in a thin glass container, wrapped in silver foil, stoppered with polylene. Nedry quickly took two of each, slipping them into the shaving cream can. Then he screwed the base of the can shut and twisted the top. There was a hiss of releasing gas inside, and the can frosted in his hands. Dodgson had said there was enough coolant to last 36 hours, more than enough time to get back to San Jose. Nedry left the freezer, returned to the main lab. He dropped the can back in his bag, zipped it shut. He went back into the hallway. The theft had taken less than 2 minutes. He could imagine the consternation upstairs in the control room as they began to realize what had happened. All their security codes were scrambled and all their phone lines were jammed. Without his help, it would take hours to untangle the mess. But in just a few minutes, Nedry would be back in the control room setting things right, and no one would ever suspect what he had done. Grinning, Dennis Nedry walked down to the ground floor, nodded to the guard, and continued downstairs to the basement. Passing the neat lines of electric Land Cruisers, he went to the gasoline-powered Jeep parked against the wall. He climbed into it, noticing some odd gray tubing on the passenger seat. It looked almost like a rocket launcher, he thought, as he turned the ignition key and started the Jeep. Nedry glanced at his watch. From here into the park, and 3 minutes straight to the East Dock. 3 minutes from there, back to the control room. Piece of cake.
Damn it, Arnold said, punching buttons on the console. It's all screwed up.
Muldoon was standing at the windows looking out at the park. The lights had gone out all over the island, except in the immediate area around the main buildings. He saw a few staff personnel hurrying to get out of the rain, but no one seemed to realize anything was wrong. Muldoon looked over at the visitor lodge, where the lights burned brightly.
Uh-oh, Arnold said. We have real trouble.
What's that? Muldoon said. He turned away from the window, and so he didn't see the Jeep drive out of the underground garage and head east along the maintenance road into the park.
That idiot Nedry turned off the security systems, Arnold said. The whole building's opened up. None of the doors are locked anymore.
I'll notify the guards, Muldoon said.
That's the least of it, Arnold said. When you turn off the security, you turn off all the peripheral fences as well.
The fences? Muldoon said.
The electrical fences, Arnold said. They're off, all over the island.
You mean,
that's right, Arnold said. The animals can get out now.
Arnold lit a cigarette. Probably nothing will happen, but you never know. Muldoon started toward the door. I better drive out and bring in the people and those two land cruisers, he said, just in case.
Muldoon quickly went downstairs to the garage. He wasn't really worried about the fences going down. Most of the dinosaurs had been in their paddocks for 9 months or more, and they had brushed up against the fences more than once with notable results. Muldoon knew how quickly animals learn to avoid shock stimuli. You could train a laboratory pigeon with just two or three stimulation events. So it was unlikely the dinosaurs would now approach the fences.
Muldoon was more concerned about what the people in the cars would do. He didn't want them getting out of the land cruisers, because once the power came back on, the cars would start moving again whether the people were inside them or not. They might be left behind. Of course, in the rain, it was unlikely they would leave the cars, but still, you never knew.
He reached the garage and hurried toward the Jeep. It was lucky, he thought, that he had had the foresight to put the launcher in it. He could start right out and be out there and... It was gone.
What the hell? Muldoon stared at the empty parking space, astonished. The Jeep was gone. What the hell was happening?
Fourth iteration. Inevitably, underlying instabilities begin to appear. Ian Malcolm. The Main Road. Rain drummed loudly on the roof of the Land Cruiser. Tim felt the night vision goggles pressing heavily on his forehead. He reached for the knob near his ear and adjusted the intensity. There was a brief phosphorescent flare, and then, in shades of electronic green and black, he could see the Land Cruiser behind, with Dr. Grant and Dr. Malcolm inside. Neat. Dr. Grant was staring out the front windshield toward him. Tim saw him pick up the radio from the dash. There was a burst of static, and then he heard Dr. Grant's voice.
Can you see us back here?
Tim picked up the radio from Ed Regis.
I see you.
Everything all right?
We're fine, Dr. Grant.
Stay in the car.
We will, don't worry.
He clicked the radio off.
Ed Regis snorted.
It's pouring down rain. Of course we'll stay in the car, he muttered.
Tim turned to look at the foliage at the side of the road. Through the goggles, the foliage was a bright, electronic green, and beyond, he could see sections of the green grid pattern of the fence. The Land Cruisers were stopped on the downslope of a hill, which must mean they were someplace near the Tyrannosaur area. It would be amazing to see a Tyrannosaur with these night vision goggles, a real thrill. Maybe the Tyrannosaur would come to the fence and look over at them. Tim wondered if its eyes would glow in the dark when he saw them. That would be neat. But he didn't see anything, and eventually he stopped looking. Everyone in the cars fell silent. The rain thrummed on the roof of the car, sheets of water streamed down over the sides of the windows. It was hard for Tim to see out, even with the goggles.
How long have we been sitting here? Malcolm asked.
I don't know, 4 or 5 minutes.
I wonder what the problem is.
Maybe a short circuit from the rain.
But it happened before the rain really started.
There was another silence. In a tense voice, Lex said,
"But there's no lightning, right?"
She'd always been afraid of lightning, and she now sat nervously squeezing her leather mitt in her hands. Dr. Grant said, "What was that? We didn't quite read that."
"Just my sister talking."
"Oh." Tim again scanned the foliage, but saw nothing. Certainly nothing as big as a tyrannosaur. He began to wonder if the tyrannosaurs came out at night. Were they nocturnal animals? Tim wasn't sure if he had ever read that. He had the feeling the tyrannosaurs were all-weather, day or night animals. The time of day didn't matter to a tyrannosaur. The rain continued to pour.
"Hell of a rain," Ed Regis said. "It's really coming down."
Lex said,
"I'm hungry."
"I know that, Lex," Regis said, "but we're stuck here, sweetie. The cars run on electricity and buried cables in the road."
"Stuck for how long?"
"Until they fix the electricity." Listening to the sound of the rain, Tim felt himself growing sleepy. He yawned and turned to look at the palm trees on the left side of the road and was startled by a sudden thump as the ground shook. He swung back just in time to catch a glimpse of a dark shape as it swiftly crossed the road between the two cars.
"Jesus!"
"What was it?"
"It was huge. It was as big as the car."
"Tim, are you there?" He picked up the radio.
"Yes, I'm here."
"Did you see it, Tim?"
"No," Tim said. "I missed it."
"What the hell was it?" Malcolm said. "Are you wearing the night vision goggles, Tim?"
"Yes, I'll watch," Tim said.
"Was it the tyrannosaur?" Ed Regis asked.
"I don't think so. It was in the road."
"But you didn't see it," Ed Regis said.
"No."
Tim felt bad that he had missed seeing the animal, whatever it was. There was a sudden white crack of lightning, and his night goggles flared bright green. He blinked his eyes and started counting. 1-1,000, 2-1,000. The thunder crashed, deafeningly loud and very close. Lex began to cry.
"Oh, no!"
"Take it easy, honey," Ed Regis said. "It's just lightning." Tim scanned the side of the road. The rain was coming down hard now, shaking the leaves with hammering drops. It made everything move. Everything seemed alive. He scanned the leaves. He stopped. There was something beyond the leaves. Tim looked up higher. Behind the foliage, beyond the fence, he saw a thick body with a pebbled, grainy surface like the bark of a tree. But it wasn't a tree. He continued to look higher, sweeping the goggles upward. He saw the huge head of the Tyrannosaurus just standing there, looking over the fence at the two Land Cruisers. The lightning flashed again, and the big animal rolled its head and bellowed in the glaring light. Then darkness and silence again, and the pounding rain. "Tim?"
"Yes, Dr. Grant?"
"You see what it is?"
"Yes, Dr. Grant."
Tim had the sense that Dr. Grant was trying to talk in a way that wouldn't upset his sister. "What's going on right now?"
"Nothing," Tim said, watching the Tyrannosaur through his night goggles. "Just standing on the other side of the fence."
"I can't see much from here, Tim."
"I can see fine, Dr. Grant. It's just standing there."
"Okay." Lex continued to cry, snuffling. There was another pause. Tim watched the Tyrannosaur. The head was huge. The animal looked from one vehicle to another, then back again. It seemed to stare right at Tim. In the goggles, the eyes glowed bright green. Tim felt a chill, but then as he looked down the animal's body, moving down from the massive head and jaws, he saw the smaller, muscular forelimb. It waved in the air, and then it gripped the fence.
"Jesus Christ," Ed Regis said, staring out the window.
The greatest predator the world has ever known, the most fearsome attack in human history. Somewhere in the back of his publicist's brain, Ed Regis was still writing copy. But he could feel his knees begin to shake uncontrollably, his trousers flapping like flags.
Jesus, he was frightened.
He didn't want to be here. Alone among all the people in the two cars, Ed Regis knew what a dinosaur attack was like. He knew what happened to people. He had seen the mangled bodies that resulted from a raptor attack. He could picture it in his mind. And this was a rex, much, much bigger. The greatest meat-eater that ever walked the earth.
Jesus!
When the Tyrannosaur roared, it was terrifying, a scream from some other world.
Ed Regis felt the spreading warmth in his trousers. He'd peed in his pants. He was simultaneously embarrassed and terrified. But he knew he had to do something. He couldn't just stay here. He had to do something. Something! His hands were shaking, trembling against the dash. Jesus Christ! He said again.
Bad language, Lex said, wagging her finger at him.
Tim heard the sound of a door opening, and he swung his head away from the Tyrannosaur. The night vision goggles streaked laterally, in time to see Ed Regis stepping out through the open door, ducking his head in the rain.
Hey, Lex said, where are you going?
Ed Regis just turned and ran in the opposite direction from the Tyrannosaur, disappearing into the woods. The door to the Land Cruiser hung open. The paneling was getting wet.
He left, Lex said. Where did he go? He left us alone.
Shut the door, Tim said. But she had started to scream.
He left us! He left us!
Tim, what's going on? It was Dr. Grant on the radio. Tim! Tim leaned forward and tried to shut the door. From the back seat, he couldn't reach the handle. He looked back at the Tyrannosaur as lightning flashed again, momentarily silhouetting the huge black shape against the white flaring sky. Tim, what's happening?
He left us! He left us!
Tim blinked to recover his vision. When he looked again, the Tyrannosaur was standing there, exactly as before, motionless and huge. Rain dripped from its jaws. The forelimb gripped the fence. And then Tim realized the Tyrannosaur was holding on to the fence. The fence wasn't electrified anymore.
Lex, close the door!
The radio crackled. Tim!
I'm here, Dr. Grant.
What's going on?
Regis ran away, Tim said.
He what?
He ran away. I think he saw that the fence isn't electrified, Tim said.
The fence isn't electrified, Malcolm said over the radio. Did he say the fence isn't electrified?
Lex, Tim said, close the door!
But Lex was screaming.
He left us! He left us!
In a steady, monotonous wail, and there was nothing for Tim to do but climb out of the back door into the slashing rain and shut the door for her. Thunder rumbled and the lightning flashed again. Tim looked up and saw the Tyrannosaur crashing down the cyclone fence with a giant hind limb.
Timmy!
He jumped back in and slammed the door, the sound lost in the thunderclap. The radio. Tim, are you there? He grabbed the radio.
I'm here.
He turned to Lex.
Lock the doors. Get in the middle of the car and shut up.
Outside, the Tyrannosaur rolled its head and took an awkward step forward. The claws of its feet had caught in the grid of the flattened fence. Lex saw the animal finally and became silent, still. She watched with wide eyes. Radio crackle. Tim.
Yes, Dr. Grant?
Stay in the car. Stay down. Be quiet. Don't move. And don't make noise.
Okay.
You should be all right. I don't think it can open the car.
Okay.
Just stay quiet so you don't arouse its attention any more than necessary.
Okay.
Tim clicked the radio off.
You hear that, Lex?
His sister nodded silently. She never took her eyes off the dinosaur. The Tyrannosaur roared. In the glare of lightning, they saw it pull free of the fence and take a bounding step forward. Now it was standing between the two cars. Tim couldn't see Dr. Grant's car anymore because the huge body blocked his view. The rain ran in rivulets down the pebbled skin of the muscular hind legs. He couldn't see the animal's head, which was high above the roofline. The Tyrannosaur moved around the side of their car. It went to the very spot where Tim had gotten out of the car, where Ed Regis had gotten out of the car. The animal paused there, the big head ducked down toward the mud. Tim looked back at Dr. Grant and Dr. Malcolm in the rear car. Their faces were tense as they stared forward through the windshield. The huge head raised back up, jaws open, and then stopped by the side windows. In the glare of lightning, they saw the beady, expressionless, reptile eye moving in the socket. It was looking in the car. His sister's breath came in ragged, frightened gasps. He reached out and squeezed her arm, hoping she would stay quiet. The dinosaur continued to stare for a long time through the side window. Perhaps the dinosaur couldn't really see them, he thought. Finally, the head lifted up out of view again.
Timmy,
Lex whispered.
It's okay, Tim whispered. I don't think it saw us.
He was looking back toward Dr. Grant when a jolting impact rocked the Land Cruiser and shattered the windshield in a spider web as a Tyrannosaur's head crashed against the hood of the Land Cruiser.
Tim was knocked flat on the seat. The night vision goggles slid off his forehead. He got back up quickly, blinking in the darkness, his mouth warm with blood. Lex? He couldn't see his sister anywhere. The Tyrannosaur stood near the front of the Land Cruiser, its chest moving as it breathed, the forelimbs making clawing movements in the air.
Lex!
Tim whispered. Then he heard her groan. She was lying somewhere on the floor, under the front seat. Then the huge head came down, entirely blocking the shattered windshield. The Tyrannosaur banged again in the front hood of the Land Cruiser. Tim grabbed the seat as the car rocked on its wheels. The Tyrannosaur banged down twice more, denting the metal. Then it moved around the side of the car. The big raised tail blocked his view out of all the side windows. At the back, the animal snorted a deep, rumbling growl that blended with the thunder. It sank its jaws into the spare tire mounted on the back of the Land Cruiser, and in a single headshake, tore it away. The rear of the car lifted into the air for a moment, then it thumped down with a muddy splash.
Tim!
Dr. Grant said. Tim! Are you there? Tim grabbed the radio.
We're okay, he said.
There was a shrill metallic scrape as claws raked the roof of the car. Tim's heart was pounding in his chest. He couldn't see anything out of the windows on the right side except pebbled, leathery flesh. The Tyrannosaur was leaning against the car, which rocked back and forth with each breath, the springs and metal creaking loudly. Lex groaned again. Tim put down the radio and started to crawl over into the front seat. The Tyrannosaur roared, and the metal roof dented downward. Tim felt a sharp pain in his head and tumbled to the floor onto the transmission hump. He found himself lying alongside Lex, and he was shocked to see that the whole side of her head was covered in blood. She looked unconscious. There was another jolting impact, and pieces of glass fell all around him. Tim felt rain. He looked up and saw that the front windshield had broken out. There was just a jagged rim of glass, and beyond, the big head of the dinosaur, looking down at him. Tim felt a sudden chill, and then the head rushed forward toward him, the jaws open. There was the squeal of metal against teeth, and he felt the hot, stinking breath of the animal, and a thick tongue stuck into the car through the windshield opening. The tongue slapped wetly around inside the car. He felt the hot lather of dinosaur saliva, and the Tyrannosaur roared, a deafening sound inside the car. The head pulled away abruptly. Tim scrambled up, avoiding the dent in the roof. There was still room to sit on the front seat by the passenger door. The Tyrannosaur stood in the rain near the front fender. It seemed confused by what had happened to it. Blood dripped freely from its jaws. The Tyrannosaur looked at Tim, cocking its head to stare with one big eye. The head moved close to the car, sideways, and peered in. Blood spattered on the dented hood of the Land Cruiser, mixing with the rain.
It can't get to me, Tim thought. It's too big.
Then the head pulled away, and in the glare of lightning he saw the hind leg lift up, and the world tilted crazily as the Land Cruiser slammed over on its side, the windows splatting in the mud. He saw Lex fall helplessly against the side window, and he fell down beside her, banging his head.
Tim felt dizzy.
Then the Tyrannosaur's jaws clamped onto the window frame, and the whole Land Cruiser was lifted up into the air and shaken.
Timmy!
Lex shrieked, so near to his ear that it hurt. She was suddenly awake, and he grabbed her as the Tyrannosaur crashed the car down again. Tim felt a stabbing pain in his side, and his sister fell on top of him. The car went up again, tilting crazily. Lex shouted, "Timmy!" And he saw the door give way beneath her, and she fell out of the car into the mud. But Tim couldn't answer, because in the next instant, everything swung crazily. He saw the trunks of the palm trees sliding downward past him, moving sideways through the air. He glimpsed the ground, very far below. The hot roar of the Tyrannosaur, the blazing eye, the tops of the palm trees. And then, with a metallic scraping shriek, the car fell from the Tyrannosaur's jaws, a sickening fall. And Tim's stomach heaved in the moment before the world became totally black and silent. In the other car, Malcolm gasped,
"Jesus, what happened to the car?"
Grant blinked his eyes as the lightning faded. The other car was gone. Grant couldn't believe it. He peered forward, trying to see through the rain-streaked windshield. The dinosaur's body was so large, it was probably just blocking... No. In another flash of lightning, he saw clearly the car was gone.
What happened?
Malcolm said. I don't know. Faintly over the rain, Grant heard the sound of the little girl screaming. The dinosaur was standing in the darkness on the road up ahead, but they could see well enough to know that it was bending over now, sniffing the ground, or eating something on the ground.
Can you see?
Malcolm said, squinting. Not much, no, Grant said. The rain pounded on the roof of the car. He listened for the little girl, but he didn't hear her anymore. The two men sat in the car, listening.
Was it the girl?
Malcolm said finally. It sounded like the girl. It did, yes.
Was it?
I don't know, Grant said. He felt a seeping fatigue overtake him. Blurred through the rainy windshield, the dinosaur was coming toward their car. Slow, ominous strides coming right toward them. Malcolm said,
You know, at times like this one feels, well, perhaps extinct animals should be left extinct. Don't you have that feeling now?
Yes, Grant said. He was feeling his heart pounding.
Do you have any suggestions about what we do now?
I can't think of a thing, Grant said. Malcolm twisted the handle, kicked open the door, and ran. But even as he did, Grant could see he was too late. The Tyrannosaur too close. There was another crack of lightning, and in that instant of glaring white light, Grant watched in horror as the Tyrannosaur roared and leapt forward. Grant was not clear about exactly what happened next. Malcolm was running, his feet splashing in the mud. The Tyrannosaur bounded alongside him and ducked its massive head, and Malcolm was tossed into the air like a small doll. By then, Grant was out of the car, too, feeling the cold rain slashing his face and body. The Tyrannosaur had turned its back to him, the huge tail swinging through the air. Grant was tensing to run for the woods, when suddenly the Tyrannosaur spun back to face him and roared. Grant froze. He was standing beside the passenger door of the Land Cruiser, drenched in rain. He was completely exposed, the Tyrannosaur no more than 8 feet away. The big animal roared again. At so close a range, the sound was terrifyingly loud. Grant felt himself shaking with cold and fright. He pressed his trembling hands against the metal of the door panel to steady them. The Tyrannosaur roared once more, but it did not attack. It cocked its head and looked with first one eye, then the other, at the Land Cruiser. And it did nothing. It just stood there.
What was going on?
The powerful jaws opened and closed. The Tyrannosaur bellowed angrily, and then the big hind leg came up and crashed down on the roof of the car. The claws slid off with a metal screech, barely missing Grant as he stood there still unmoving. The foot splashed in the mud. The head ducked down in a slow arc, and the animal inspected the car, snorting. It peered into the front windshield. Then, moving toward the rear, it banged the passenger door shut and moved right toward Grant as he stood there. Grant was dizzy with fear, his heart pounding inside his chest. With the animal so close, he could smell the rotten flesh in the mouth, the sweetish blood smell, the sickening stench of the carnivore. He tensed his body, awaiting the inevitable. The big head slid past him, toward the rear of the car. Grant blinked. What had happened? Was it possible the Tyrannosaur hadn't seen him? It seemed as if it hadn't, but how could that be? Grant looked back to see the animal sniffing the rear-mounted tire. It nudged the tire with its snout, and then the head swung back. Again, it approached Grant. This time the animal stopped, the black flaring nostrils just inches away. Grant felt the animal's startling hot breath on his face. But the Tyrannosaur wasn't sniffing like a dog, it was just breathing. And if anything, it seemed puzzled. No, the Tyrannosaur couldn't see him, not if he stood motionless. And in a detached academic corner of his mind, he found an explanation for that, a reason why. The jaws opened before him, the massive head raised up. Grant squeezed his fists together and bit his lip, trying desperately to remain motionless, to make no sound. The Tyrannosaur bellowed in the night air. But by now, Grant was beginning to understand. The animal couldn't see him, but it suspected he was there, somewhere,
and was trying with its bellowing to frighten Grant into some revealing movement. So long as he stood his ground, Grant realized he was invisible. In a final gesture of frustration, the big hind leg lifted up and kicked the Land Cruiser over, and Grant felt searing pain and the surprising sensation of his own body flying through the air. It seemed to be happening very slowly, and he had plenty of time to feel the world turn colder and watch the ground rush up to strike him in the face. Return. Oh, damn, Harding said. Will you look at that? They were sitting in Harding's gasoline-powered Jeep, staring forward past the flick-flick of the windshield wipers. In the yellow flare of the headlamps, a big fallen tree blocked the road. Must have been the lightning, Gennaro said. Hell of a tree. We can't get past it, Harding said. I better tell Arnold in control. He picked up the radio and twisted the channel dial. Hello, John. Are you there, John? There was nothing but steady, hissing static. I don't understand, he said. The radio lines seem to be down. It must be the storm, Gennaro said. I suppose, Harding said.
Try the Land Cruisers, Ellie said.
Harding opened the other channels, but there was no answer. Nothing, he said. They're probably back to camp by now, and outside the range of our little set. In any case, I don't think we should stay here. It'll be hours before maintenance gets a crew out here to move that tree. He turned the radio off and put the Jeep into reverse.
What are you going to do?
Ellie said. Go back to the turnout and get onto the maintenance road. Fortunately, there's a second road system, Harding explained. We have one road for visitors and a second road for animal handlers and feed trucks and so on. We'll drive back on that maintenance road. It's a little longer and not so scenic, but you may find it interesting. If the rain lets up, we'll get a glimpse of some of the animals at night. We should be back in 30-40 minutes, Harding said, if I don't get lost. He turned the Jeep around in the night and headed south again. Lightning flashed, and every monitor in the control room went black. Arnold sat forward, his body rigid and tense. Jesus, not now, not now. That was all he needed, to have everything go out now in the storm. All the main power circuits were surge-protected, of course, but Arnold wasn't sure about the modems Nedry was using for his data transmission. Most people didn't know it was possible to blow an entire system through a modem. The lightning pulse climbed back into the computer through the telephone line, and bang, no more motherboard, no more RAM, no more file server, no more computer. The screens flickered, and then one by one they came back on. Arnold sighed and collapsed back in his chair. He wondered again where Nedry had gone. 5 minutes ago, he'd sent guards to search the building for him. The fat bastard was probably in the bathroom reading a comic book. But the guards hadn't come back, and they hadn't called in. 5 minutes. If Nedry was in the building, they should have found him by now. Somebody took the damn Jeep, Muldoon said as he came back in the room. Have you talked to the Land Cruisers yet? Can't raise them on the radio, Arnold said. I have to use this because the main board is down. It's weak, but it ought to work. I've tried on all six channels. I know they have radios in the cars, but they're not answering. That's not good, Muldoon said. If you want to go out there, take one of the maintenance vehicles. I would, Muldoon said, but they're all in the east garage, more than a mile from here. Where's Harding? I assume he's on his way back. Then he'll pick up the people in the Land Cruisers on his way. I assume so. Anybody tell Hammond the kids aren't back yet? Hell no, Arnold said. I don't want that son of a bitch running around here screaming at me. Everything's all right for the moment. The Land Cruisers are just stuck in the rain. They can sit a while until Harding brings them back. Or until we find Nedry and make that little bastard turn the systems back on. You can't get them back on? Muldoon said. Arnold shook his head. I've been trying, but Nedry's done something to the system. I can't figure out what. But if I have to go into the code itself, that'll take hours. We need Nedry. We've got to find the son of a bitch right away. Nedry. The sign said, electrified fence, 10,000 volts, do not touch. But Nedry opened it with his bare hand and unlocked the gate, swinging it wide. He went back to the Jeep, drove through the gate, and then walked back to close it behind him. Now he was inside the park itself, no more than a mile from the east dock. He stepped on the accelerator and hunched forward over the steering wheel, peering through the rain-slashed windshield as he drove the Jeep down the narrow road. He was driving fast, too fast, but he had to keep to his timetable. He was surrounded on all sides by black jungle, but soon he should be able to see the beach and the ocean off to his left. This damn storm, he thought. It might screw up everything, because if Dodgson's boat wasn't waiting for him at the east dock when Nedry got there, the whole plan would be ruined. Nedry couldn't wait very long, or he would be missed back at the control room. The whole idea behind the plan was that he could drive to the east dock, drop off the embryos, and be back in a few minutes before anyone noticed. It was a good plan, a clever plan. Nedry'd worked on it carefully, refining every detail. This plan was going to make him $1.5 million, 1.5 meg. That was 10 years of income in a single tax-free shot, and it was going to change his life. Nedry'd been damn careful, even to the point of making Dodgson meet him in the San Francisco airport at the last minute with an excuse about wanting to see the money. Actually, Nedry wanted to record his conversation with Dodgson and mention him by name on the tape, just so that Dodgson wouldn't forget he owed the rest of the money. Nedry was including a copy of the tape with the embryos. In short, Nedry had thought of everything. Except this damn storm. Something dashed across the road, a white flash in his headlights. It looked like a large rat. It scurried into the underbrush, dragging a fat tail. Possum. Amazing that a possum could survive here. You'd think the dinosaurs would get an animal like that. Where was the damn dock? He was driving fast, and he'd already been gone 5 minutes. He should have reached the east dock by now. Had he taken a wrong turn? He didn't think so. He hadn't seen any forks in the road at all. Then where was the dock? It was a shock when he came around a corner and saw that the road terminated in a gray concrete barrier, 6 feet tall and streaked dark with rain. He slammed on the brakes, and the Jeep fishtailed, losing traction in an end-to-end spin. And for a horrified moment, he thought he was going to smash into the barrier. He knew he was going to smash. And he spun the wheel frantically, and the Jeep slid to a stop, the headlamps just a foot from the concrete wall. He paused there, listening to the rhythmic flick of the wipers. He took a deep breath and exhaled slowly. He looked back down the road. He'd obviously taken a wrong turn somewhere. He could retrace his steps, but that would take too long. He'd better try and find out where the hell he was. He got out of the Jeep, feeling heavy raindrops spatter his head. It was a real tropical storm, raining so hard that it hurt. He glanced at his watch, pushing the button to illuminate the digital dial. 6 minutes gone. Where the hell was he? He walked around the concrete barrier, and on the other side, along with the rain, he heard the sound of gurgling water. Could it be the ocean? Nedry hurried forward, his eyes adjusting to the darkness as he went. Dense jungle on all sides, raindrops slapping on the leaves. The gurgling sound became louder, drawing him forward. And suddenly he came out of the foliage and felt his feet sink into soft earth and saw the dark currents of the river. The river! He was at the jungle river. Damn, he thought. At the river where? The river ran for miles through the island. He looked at his watch again. 7 minutes gone. You have a problem, Dennis, he said aloud. As if in reply, there was a soft hooting cry of an owl in the forest. Nedry hardly noticed. He was worrying about his plan. The plain fact was that time had run out. There wasn't a choice anymore. He had to abandon his original plan. All he could do was go back to the control room, restore the computer, and somehow try to contact Dodgson to set up the drop at the east dock for the following night. Nedry would have to scramble to make that work, but he thought he could pull it off. The computer automatically logged all calls. After Nedry got through to Dodgson, he'd have to go back into the computer and erase the record of the call, but one thing was sure. He couldn't stay out in the park any longer, or his absence would be noticed. Nedry started back, heading toward the glow of the car's headlights. He was drenched and miserable. He heard the soft hooting cry once more, and this time he paused. That hadn't really sounded like an owl, and it seemed to be close by, in the jungle, somewhere off to his right.
As he listened, he heard a crashing sound in the underbrush, then silence. He waited and heard it again. It sounded distinctly like something big, moving slowly through the jungle toward him. Something big, something near, a big dinosaur. Get out of here. Nedry began to run. He made a lot of noise as he ran, but even so, he could hear the animal crashing through the foliage and hooting. It was coming closer. Stumbling over tree roots in the darkness, clawing his way past dripping branches, he saw the jeep ahead, and the lights shining around the vertical wall of the barrier made him feel better. In a moment, he'd be in the car, and then he'd get the hell out of here. He scrambled around the barrier, and then he froze. The animal was already there. But it wasn't close. The dinosaur stood 40 feet away at the edge of the illumination from the headlamps. Nedry hadn't taken the tour, so he hadn't seen the different types of dinosaurs, but this one was strange-looking. The 10-foot-tall body was yellow with black spots, and along the head ran a pair of red, V-shaped crests. The dinosaur didn't move, but again gave its soft hooting cry. Nedry waited to see if it would attack. It didn't. Perhaps the headlights from the jeep frightened it, forcing it to keep its distance like a fire. The dinosaur stared at him, and then snapped its head in a single swift motion. Nedry felt something smack wetly against his chest. He looked down and saw a dripping glob of foam on his rain-soaked shirt. He touched it curiously, not comprehending. It was spit. The dinosaur had spit on him. It was creepy, he thought. He looked back at the dinosaur and saw the head snap again, and immediately felt another wet smack against his neck, just above the shirt collar. He wiped it away with his hand. Jesus, it was disgusting. But the skin of his neck was already starting to tingle and burn, and his hand was tingling too. It was almost like he had been touched with acid. Nedry opened the car door, glancing back at the dinosaur to make sure it wasn't going to attack, and felt a sudden excruciating pain in his eyes, stabbing like spikes into the back of his skull, and he squeezed his eyes shut and gasped with the intensity of it, then threw up his hands to cover his eyes and felt the slippery foam trickling down both sides of his nose. Spit. The dinosaur had spit in his eyes. Even as he realized it, the pain overwhelmed him, and he dropped to his knees, disoriented, wheezing. He collapsed onto his side, his cheek pressed to the wet ground, his breath coming in thin whistles through the constant, ever-screaming pain that caused flashing spots of light to appear behind his tightly shut eyelids. The earth shook beneath him, and Nedry knew the dinosaur was moving. He could hear its soft hooting cry, and despite the pain, he forced his eyes open, and still he saw nothing but flashing spots against black. Slowly the realization came to him. He was blind. The hooting was louder as Nedry scrambled to his feet and staggered back against the side panel of the car as a wave of nausea and dizziness swept over him. The dinosaur was close now. He could feel it coming close. He was dimly aware of its snorting breath, but he couldn't see. He couldn't see anything. And his terror was extreme. He stretched out his hands, waving them wildly in the air to ward off the attack he knew was coming. And then there was a new searing pain, like a fiery knife in his belly. And Nedry stumbled, reaching blindly down to touch the ragged edge of his shirt, and then a thick, slippery mass that was surprisingly warm. And with horror, he suddenly knew he was holding his own intestines in his hands. The dinosaur had torn him open. His guts had fallen out. Nedry fell to the ground and landed on something scaly and cold. It was the animal's foot. And then there was a new pain on both sides of his head. The pain grew worse. And as he was lifted to his feet, he knew the dinosaur had his head in its jaws. And the horror of that realization was followed by a final wish that it would all be ended soon. Bungalow. More coffee? Hammond asked politely. No, thank you, Henry Wu said, leaning back in his chair. I couldn't eat anything more. They were sitting in the dining room of Hammond's bungalow in a secluded corner of the park not far from the labs. Wu had to admit that the bungalow Hammond had built for himself was elegant, with sparse, almost Japanese lines.
and the dinner had been excellent, considering the dining room wasn't fully staffed yet. But there was something about Hammond that Wu found troubling. The old man was different in some way, subtly different. All during dinner, Wu had tried to decide what it was. In part, a tendency to ramble, to repeat himself, to retell old stories. In part, it was an emotional lability, flaring anger one moment, maudlin sentimentality the next. But all that could be understood as a natural concomitant of age. John Hammond was, after all, almost 77. But there was something else. A stubborn evasiveness, an insistence on having his way, and in the end a complete refusal to deal with the situation that now faced the park. Wu had been stunned by the evidence. He did not yet allow himself to believe the case was proved, that the dinosaurs were breeding. After Grant had asked about amphibian DNA, Wu had intended to go directly to his laboratory and check the computer records of the various DNA assemblies. Because if the dinosaurs were in fact breeding, then everything about Jurassic Park was called into question. Their genetic development methods, their genetic control methods, everything. Even the lysine dependency might be suspect. And if these animals could truly breed and could also survive in the wild... Henry Wu wanted to check the data at once, but Hammond had stubbornly insisted Wu accompany him at dinner.
"Now then, Henry, you must save room for ice cream," Hammond said, pushing back from the table. "Maria makes the most wonderful ginger ice cream."
"All right." Wu looked at the beautiful, silent serving girl. His eyes followed her out of the room, and then he glanced up at the single video monitor mounted in the wall. The monitor was dark. "Your monitor's out," Wu said.
"Is it?" Hammond glanced over. "Must be the storm."
He reached behind him for the telephone.
"I'll just check with John in control."
Wu could hear the static crackle on the telephone line. Hammond shrugged and set the receiver back in its cradle.
"Lines must be down," he said. "Or maybe Nedry's still doing data transmission. He has quite a few bugs to fix this weekend. Nedry's a genius in his way, but we had to press him quite hard toward the end to make sure he got things right."
"Perhaps I should go to the control room and check," Wu said.
"No, no," Hammond said. "There's no reason. If there were any problem, we'd hear about it."
"Ah." Maria came back into the room with two plates of ice cream.
"You must have just a little, Henry," Hammond said. "It's made with fresh ginger from the eastern part of the island. It's an old man's vice ice cream, but still..."
Dutifully, Wu dipped his spoon. Outside, lightning flashed, and there was the sharp crack of thunder. "That was close," Wu said. "I hope the storm isn't frightening the children."
"I shouldn't think so," Hammond said.
He tasted the ice cream.
"And I can't help but hold some fears about this park, Henry."
Inwardly, Wu felt relieved. Perhaps the old man was going to face the facts after all.
"What kind of fears?" "You know, Jurassic Park's really made for children. The children of the world love dinosaurs, and the children are going to delight, just delight in this place. Their little faces will shine with the joy of finally seeing these wonderful animals. But I am afraid I may not live to see it, Henry. I may not live to see the joy on their faces." "I think there are other problems, too," Wu said, frowning. "But none so pressing on my mind as this," Hammond said, "that I may not live to see their shining, delighted faces. This is our triumph, this park. We have done what we set out to do. And you remember our original intent was to use the newly emerging technology of genetic engineering to make money. A lot of money."
Wu knew Hammond was about to launch into one of his old speeches. He held up his hand.
"I'm familiar with this, John. If you were going to start a bioengineering company, Henry, what would you do? Would you make products to help mankind? To fight illness and disease?" "Dear me, no. That's a terrible idea. A very poor use of new technology."
Hammond shook his head sadly.
"Yet you'll remember," he said, "the original genetic engineering companies like Genentech and Cetus were all started to make pharmaceuticals. New drugs for mankind. Noble, noble purpose. Unfortunately, drugs face all kinds of barriers. FDA testing alone takes 5 to 8 years, if you're lucky. Even worse, there are forces at work in the marketplace. Suppose you make a miracle drug for cancer or heart disease, as Genentech did. Suppose you now want to charge $1,000 or $2,000 a dose. You might imagine that is your privilege. After all, you invented the drug. You paid to develop and test it. You should be able to charge whatever you wish. But do you really think that the government will let you do that? No, Henry, they will not. Sick people aren't going to pay $1,000 a dose for needed medication. They won't be grateful, they'll be outraged. Blue Cross isn't going to pay it. They'll scream highway robbery. So something will happen. Your patent application will be denied, your permits will be delayed. Something will force you to see reason and to sell your drug at a lower cost. From a business standpoint, that makes helping mankind a very risky business. Personally, I would never help mankind. Wu had heard the argument before, and he knew Hammond was right. Some new bioengineered pharmaceuticals had indeed suffered inexplicable delays and patent problems. Now, Hammond said, think how different it is when you're making entertainment. Nobody needs entertainment. That's not a matter for government intervention. If I charge $5,000 a day for my park, who is going to stop me? After all, nobody needs to come here. And far from being highway robbery, a costly price tag actually increases the appeal of the park. A visit becomes a status symbol, and all Americans love that. So do the Japanese. And, of course, they have far more money. Hammond finished his ice cream, and Maria silently took the dish away. She's not from here, you know, he said. She's Haitian. Her mother is French. But in any case, Henry, you will recall that the original purpose behind pointing my company in this direction in the first place was to have freedom from government intervention anywhere in the world.
Speaking of the rest of the world, Hammond smiled,
we have already leased a large tract in the Azores for Jurassic Park Europe, and you know we long ago obtained an island near Guam for Jurassic Park Japan. Construction on the next two Jurassic Parks will begin early next year. They will all be open within 4 years. At that time, direct revenues will exceed $10 billion a year. And merchandising, television, and ancillary rights should double that. I see no reason to bother with children's pets, which I'm told Lou Dodgson thinks we're planning to make.
$20 billion a year, Wu said softly, shaking his head.
That's speaking conservatively, Hammond said. He smiled. There's no reason to speculate wildly. More ice cream, Henry.
Did you find him? Arnold snapped when the guard walked into the control room.
No, Mr. Arnold. Find him. I don't think he's in the building, Mr. Arnold.
Then look in the lodge, Arnold said. Look in the maintenance building. Look in the utility shed. Look everywhere. But just find him.
The thing is, the guard hesitated, Mr. Nedry's the fat man, is that right?
That's right, Arnold said. He's fat. A fat slob.
Well, Jimmy, down in the main lobby, said he saw the fat man go into the garage.
Muldoon spun around. Into the garage? When?
About 10-15 minutes ago.
Jesus, Muldoon said.
The jeep screeched to a stop. Sorry, Harding said. In the headlamps, Ellie saw a herd of apatosaurs lumbering across the road. There were 6 animals, each the size of a house, and a baby as large as a full-grown horse. The apatosaurs moved in unhurried silence, never looking toward the jeep and its glowing headlamps. At one point, the baby stopped to lap water from a puddle in the road, then moved on. A comparable herd of elephants would have been startled by the arrival of a car, would have trumpeted and circled to protect the baby. But these animals showed no fear.
Don't they see us? She said.
Not exactly, no, Harding said. Of course, in a literal sense, they do see us. But we don't really mean anything to them. We hardly ever take cars out at night, and so they have no experience of them. We are just a strange, smelly object in their environment, representing no threat, and therefore no interest. I've occasionally been out at night visiting a sick animal, and on my way back, these fellows block the road for an hour or more.
What do you do?
Harding grinned. Play a recorded tyrannosaur roar. That gets them moving. Not that they care much about tyrannosaurs. These apatosaurs are so big, they don't really have any predators. They can break a tyrannosaur's neck with a swipe of their tail. And they know it. So does the tyrannosaur.
But they do see us. I mean, if we were to get out of the car...
Harding shrugged. They probably wouldn't react. Dinosaurs have excellent visual acuity, but they have a basic amphibian visual system. It's attuned to movement. They don't see unmoving things well at all. The animals moved on, their skin glistening in the rain. Harding put the car in gear. I think we can continue now, he said. Wu said, I suspect you may find there are pressures on your park, just as there are pressures on Genentech's drugs. He and Hammond had moved to the living room, and they were now watching the storm lash the big glass windows. I can't see how, Hammond said. The scientists may wish to constrain you, even to stop you.
Well, they can't do that, Hammond said. He shook his finger at Wu. You know why the scientists would try to do that? It's because they want to do research, of course. It's all they ever want to do is research. Not to accomplish anything. Not to make any progress, just do research. Well, they have a surprise coming to them.
I wasn't thinking of that, Wu said.
Hammond sighed.
I'm sure it would be interesting for the scientists to do research. But you arrive at the point where these animals are simply too expensive to be used for research. This is wonderful technology, Henry. But it's also frightfully expensive technology. The fact is, it can only be supported as entertainment.
Hammond shrugged. That's just the way it is.
But if there are attempts to close down...
Face the damn facts, Henry, Hammond said irritably. This isn't America. This isn't even Costa Rica. This is my island. I own it. And nothing is going to stop me from opening Jurassic Park to all the children of the world.
He chuckled.
Or at least to the rich ones. And I tell you, they'll love it.
In the back seat of the Jeep, Ellie Sattler stared out the window. They had been driving through rain-drenched jungle for the last 20 minutes and had seen nothing since the apatosaurs crossed the road.
We're near the jungle river now, Harding said as he drove. It's off there somewhere to our left.
Abruptly, he slammed on the brakes again. The car skidded to a stop in front of a flock of small green animals.
Well, you're getting quite a show tonight, he said. Those are compies.
Procomp sognathids, Ellie thought, wishing that Grant were here to see them. This was the animal they had seen in the facts, back in Montana. The little dark green Procomp sognathids scurried to the other side of the road, then squatted on their hind legs to look at the car, chittering briefly, before hurrying onward into the night.
Odd, Harding said. Wonder where they're off to. Compies don't usually move at night, you know. They climb up in a tree and wait for daylight.
Then why are they out now? Ellie said.
I can't imagine. You know, compies are scavengers, like buzzards. They're attracted to a dying animal, and they have tremendously sensitive smell. They can smell a dying animal for miles.
Then they're going to a dying animal?
Dying or already dead.
Should we follow them? Ellie said.
I'd be curious, Harding said. Yes, why not? Let's go see where they're going. He turned the car around and headed back toward the compies. Tim Murphy lay in the Land Cruiser, his cheek pressed against the car door handle. He drifted slowly back to consciousness. He wanted only to sleep. He shifted his position and felt the pain in his cheekbone where it lay against the metal door. His whole body ached, his arms and his legs, and most of all his head. There was a terrible pounding pain in his head. All the pain made him want to go back to sleep. He pushed himself up on one elbow, opened his eyes, and retched, vomiting all over his shirt. He tasted sour bile and wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. His head throbbed. He felt dizzy and seasick, as if the world were moving, as if he were rocking back and forth on a boat. Tim groaned and rolled onto his back, turning away from the puddle of vomit. The pain in his head made him breathe in short, shallow gasps, and he still felt sick, as if everything were moving. He opened his eyes and looked around, trying to get his bearings. He was inside the Land Cruiser. But the car must have flipped over on its side because he was lying on his back against the passenger door, looking up at the steering wheel and beyond at the branches of a tree moving in the wind. The rain had nearly stopped, but water drops still fell on him through the broken front windshield. He stared curiously at the fragments of glass. He couldn't remember how the windshield had broken. He couldn't remember anything, except that they had been parked in the road, and he had been talking to Dr. Grant when the Tyrannosaur came toward them. That was the last thing he remembered. He felt sick again and closed his eyes until the nausea passed. He was aware of a rhythmic creaking sound, like the rigging of a boat. Dizzy and sick to his stomach, he really felt as if the whole car were moving beneath him. But when he opened his eyes again, he saw it was true. The Land Cruiser was moving, lying on its side, swaying back and forth. The whole car was moving. Tentatively, Tim rose to his feet. Standing on the passenger door, he peered over the dashboard, looking out through the shattered windshield. At first, he saw only dense foliage moving in the wind, but here and there he could see gaps, and beyond the foliage, the ground was 20 feet below him. He stared uncomprehendingly. The Land Cruiser was lying on its side in the branches of a large tree, 20 feet above the ground, swaying back and forth in the wind. "Oh, shit," he said. What was he going to do? He stood on his tiptoes and peered out, trying to see better, grabbing the steering wheel for support. The wheel spun free in his hand, and with a loud crack, the Land Cruiser shifted position, dropping a few feet in the branches of the tree. He looked down through the shattered glass of the passenger door window at the ground below. Oh, shit," he kept repeating it. Oh, shit." Another loud crack. The Land Cruiser jolted down another foot. He had to get out of here. He looked down at his feet. He was standing on the door handle. He crouched back down on his hands and knees to look at the handle. He couldn't see very well in the dark, but he could tell that the door was dented outward, so the handle couldn't turn. He'd never get the door open. He tried to roll the window down, but the window was stuck too. Then he thought of the back door. Maybe he could open that. He leaned over the front seat, and the Land Cruiser lurched with a shift in weight. Carefully, Tim reached back and twisted the handle on the rear door. It was stuck, too. How was he going to get out? He heard a snorting sound and looked down. A dark shape passed below him. It wasn't the Tyrannosaur. This shape was tubby, and it made a kind of snuffling as it waddled along. The tail flopped back and forth, and Tim could see the long spikes. It was the Stegosaur, apparently recovered from its illness. Tim wondered where the other people were, Gennaro and Sattler and the vet. He had last seen them near the Stegosaur. How long ago was that? He looked at his watch, but the face was cracked. He couldn't see the numbers. He took the watch off and tossed it aside. The Stegosaur snuffled and moved on. Now the only sound was the wind in the trees and the creaking of the Land Cruiser as it shifted back and forth. He had to get out of here. Tim grabbed the handle, tried to force it, but it was stuck solid. It wouldn't move at all. Then he realized what was wrong. The rear door was locked. Tim pulled up the pin and twisted the handle. The rear door swung open, downward, and came to rest against the branch a few feet below. The opening was narrow, but Tim thought he could wriggle through it. Holding his breath, he crawled slowly back into the rear seat. The Land Cruiser creaked, but held its position. Gripping the doorposts on both sides, Tim slowly lowered himself down through the narrow, angled opening of the door. Soon he was lying flat on his stomach on the slanted door, his legs sticking out of the car. He kicked in the air. His feet touched something solid, a branch, and he rested his feet on it. As soon as he did, the branch bent down and the door swung wider, spilling him out of the Land Cruiser, and he fell, leaves scratching his face, his body bouncing from branch to branch, a jolt, searing pain, bright light in his head. He slammed to a stop, the wind knocked from him. Tim lay doubled over a large branch, his stomach burning pain. Tim heard another crack and looked up at the Land Cruiser, a big, dark shape 5 feet above him. Another crack. The car shifted. Tim forced himself to move, to climb down.
He used to like to climb trees. He was a good tree climber. And this was a good tree to climb. The branches spaced close together, almost like a staircase. Crack! The car was definitely moving. Tim scrambled downward, slipping over the wet branches, feeling sticky sap on his hands, hurrying. He had not descended more than a few feet when the Land Cruiser creaked a final time and then slowly, very slowly, nosed over. Tim could see the big green grille and the front headlights swinging down at him, and then the Land Cruiser fell free, gaining momentum as it rushed toward him, slamming against the branch where Tim had just been, and it stopped. His face, just inches from the dented grill, bent inward like an evil mouth, headlamps for eyes. Oil dripped on Tim's face. He was still 12 feet above the ground. He reached down, found another branch, and moved down. Above, he saw the branch bending under the weight of the Land Cruiser, and then it cracked, and the Land Cruiser came rushing down toward him, and he knew he could never escape it. He could never get down fast enough, so Tim just let go. He fell the rest of the way. Tumbling, banging, feeling pain in every part of his body, hearing the Land Cruiser smashing down through the branches after him like a pursuing animal, and then Tim's shoulder hit the soft ground, and he rolled as hard as he could and pressed his body against the trunk of the tree as the Land Cruiser tumbled down with a loud metallic crash and a sudden hot burst of electrical sparks that stung his skin and sputtered and sizzled on the wet ground around him. Slowly, Tim got to his feet. In the darkness, he heard the snuffling and saw the stegosaur coming back, apparently attracted by the crash of the Land Cruiser. The dinosaur moved dumbly, the low head thrust forward, and the big cartilaginous plates running in two rows along the hump of the back. It behaved like an overgrown tortoise, stupid like that, and slow. Tim picked up a rock and threw it. "Get away!" The rock thunked dully off the plates. The stegosaur kept coming. "Go on! Go!" He threw another rock and hit the stegosaur in the head. The animal grunted, turned slowly away, and shuffled off in the direction it had come. Tim leaned against the crumpled Land Cruiser and looked around in the darkness. He had to get back to the others, but he didn't want to get lost. He knew he was somewhere in the park, probably not far from the main road. If he could only get his bearings. He couldn't see much in the dark, but then he remembered the goggles. He climbed through the shattered front windshield into the Land Cruiser and found the night vision goggles and the radio. The radio was broken and silent, so he left it behind, but the goggles still worked. He flicked them on, saw the reassuringly familiar phosphorescent green image. Wearing the goggles, he saw the battered fence off to his left and walked toward it. The fence was 12 feet high, but the Tyrannosaur had flattened it easily. Tim hurried across it, moved through an area of dense foliage, and came out onto the main road. Through his goggles, he saw the other Land Cruiser turned on its side. He ran toward it, took a breath, and looked inside. The car was empty. No sign of Dr. Grant and Dr. Malcolm. Where had they gone? Where had everybody gone? He felt sudden panic, standing alone in the jungle road at night with that empty car, and turned quickly in circles, seeing the bright green world in the goggles swirl. Something pale by the side of the road caught his eye. It was Lex's baseball. He wiped the mud off it. "Lex!" Tim shouted as loud as he could, not caring if the animals heard him. He listened, but there was only the wind and the plink of raindrops falling from the trees. "Lex!" He vaguely remembered that she had been in the Land Cruiser when the Tyrannosaur attacked. Had she stayed there? Or had she gotten away? The events of the attack were confused in his mind. He wasn't exactly sure what had happened. Just to think of it made him uneasy. He stood in the road, gasping with panic. "Lex!" The night seemed to close in around him. Feeling sorry for himself, he sat in a cold, rainy puddle in the road and whimpered for a while. When he finally stopped, he still heard whimpering. It was faint, and it was coming from somewhere farther up the road. "How long has it been?" Muldoon said, coming back into the control room. He was carrying a black metal case. "Half an hour. Harding's jeep should be back here by now." Arnold stubbed out his cigarette.
I'm sure they'll arrive any minute now. Still no sign of Nedry? Muldoon said. Nope, not yet. Muldoon opened the case, which contained 6 portable radios. I'm going to distribute these to people in the building. He handed one to Arnold. Take the charger, too. These are our emergency radios, but nobody had them plugged in, naturally. Let it charge about 20 minutes and then try and raise the cars. Henry Wu opened the door marked fertilization and entered the darkened lab. There was nobody here. Apparently, all the technicians were still at dinner. Wu went directly to the computer terminal and punched up the DNA logbooks. The logbooks had to be kept on computer. DNA was such a large molecule that each species required 10 gigabytes of optical disk space to store details of all the iterations. He was going to have to check all 15 species. That was a tremendous amount of information to search through. He still wasn't clear about why Grant thought frog DNA was important. Wu himself didn't often distinguish one kind of DNA from another. After all, most DNA in living creatures was exactly the same. DNA was an incredibly ancient substance. Human beings walking around in the streets of the modern world, bouncing their pink new babies, hardly stopped to think that the substance at the center of it all, the substance that began the dance of life, was a chemical almost as old as the Earth itself. The DNA molecule was so old that its evolution had essentially finished more than 2 billion years ago. There had been little new since that time. Just a few recent combinations of the old genes and not much of that. When you compared the DNA of man and the DNA of a lowly bacterium, you found that only about 10% of the strands were different. This innate conservatism of DNA emboldened Wu to use whatever DNA he wished. In making his dinosaurs, Wu had manipulated the DNA as a sculptor might clay or marble. He had created freely. He started the computer search program, knowing it would take 2 or 3 minutes to run. He got up and walked around the lab, checking instruments out of long-standing habit. He noted the recorder outside the freezer door, which tracked the freezer temperature. He saw there was a spike in the graph. That was odd, he thought. It meant somebody had been in the freezer. Recently, too, within the last half hour. But who would go in there at night? The computer beeped, signaling that the first of the data searches was complete. Wu went over to see what it had found, and when he saw the screen, he forgot all about the freezer and the graph spike. Leitzke DNA search algorithm. DNA. Version search criteria. RNA. All. Fragment. Len greater than 0. DNA incorporating RNA fragments. Myosaurs, versions 2.1 to 2.9. Procompsognathids, versions 3.0 to 3.7. Othnelia, versions 3.1 to 3.3. Velociraptors, version 1.0 to 3.0. Ipsilophodontids, versions 2.4 to 2.7. The result was clear. All breeding dinosaurs incorporated RANA, or frog DNA. None of the other animals did. Wu still did not understand why this had caused them to breed, but he could no longer deny that Grant was right. The dinosaurs were breeding. He hurried up to the control room. Lex. She was curled up inside a big 1-meter drainage pipe that ran under the road. She had her baseball glove in her mouth, and she was rocking back and forth, banging her head repeatedly against the back of the pipe. It was dark in there, but he could see her clearly with his goggles. She seemed unhurt, and he felt a great burst of relief. Lex, it's me, Tim. She didn't answer. She continued to bang her head on the pipe.
Come on out.
She shook her head no. He could see she was badly frightened.
Lex, he said. If you come out, I'll let you wear these night goggles.
She just shook her head.
Look what I have, he said, holding up his hand.
She stared uncomprehendingly. It was probably too dark for her to see.
It's your ball, Lex. I found your ball.
So what?
He tried another approach.
It must be uncomfortable in there. Cold, too. Wouldn't you like to come out?
She resumed banging her head against the pipe.
Why not?
There's aminals out there.
That threw him for a moment. She hadn't said aminals for years. The aminals are gone, he said.
There's a big one. A Tyrannosaurus rex.
He's gone.
Where did he go?
I don't know, but he's not around here now, Tim said, hoping it was true. Lex didn't move. He heard her banging again. Tim sat down in the grass outside the pipe where she could see him. The ground was wet where he sat. He hugged his knees and waited. He couldn't think of anything else to do. I'm just gonna sit here, he said, and rest.
Is Daddy out there?
No, he said, feeling strange. He's back at home, Lex.
Is Mommy?
No, Lex.
Are there any grown-ups out there?
Lex said. Not yet, but I'm sure they'll come soon. They're probably on their way right now.
Then he heard her moving inside the pipe, and she came out. Shivering with cold and with dried blood on her forehead, but otherwise, all right. She looked around in surprise and said,
Where's Dr. Grant?
I don't know.
Well, he was here before.
He was? When?
Before,
Lex said.
I saw him when I was in the pipe.
Where'd he go?
How am I supposed to know?
Lex said, wrinkling her nose.
She began to shout,
Hello! Hello! Dr. Grant! Dr. Grant!
Tim was uneasy at the noise she was making. It might bring back the Tyrannosaur. But a moment later, he heard an answering shout. It was coming from the right, over toward the Land Cruiser that Tim had left a few minutes before. With his goggles, Tim saw with relief that Dr. Grant was walking toward them. He had a big tear in his shirt at the shoulder, but otherwise he looked okay. Thank God, he said. I've been looking for you. Shivering, Ed Regis got to his feet and wiped the cold mud off his face and hands. He had spent a very bad half hour wedged among big boulders on the slope of a hill below the road. He knew it wasn't much of a hiding place, but he was panicked, and he wasn't thinking clearly. He had lain in this muddy, cold place, and he had tried to get hold of himself, but he kept seeing that dinosaur in his mind, that dinosaur coming toward him, toward the car. Ed Regis didn't remember exactly what had happened after that. He remembered that Lex had said something, but he hadn't stopped. He couldn't stop. He had just kept running and running. Beyond the road, he had lost his footing and tumbled down the hill and come to rest by some boulders. And it had seemed to him that he could crawl in among the boulders and hide. There was enough room. So that was what he had done. Gasping and terrified, thinking of nothing except to get away from the Tyrannosaur. And finally, when he was wedged in there like a rat between the boulders, he had calmed down a little. And he had been overcome with horror and shame because he'd abandoned those kids. He had just run away. He had just saved himself. He knew he should go back up to the road. He should try to rescue them because he had always imagined himself as brave and cool under pressure. But whenever he tried to get control of himself to make himself go back up there, somehow he just couldn't. He started to feel panicky and he had trouble breathing and he didn't move. He told himself it was hopeless anyway. If the kids were still up there on the road, they could never survive. And certainly there was nothing Ed Regis could do for them, and he might as well stay where he was. No one was going to know what had happened except him, and there was nothing he could do, nothing he could have done. And so Regis had remained among the boulders for half an hour, fighting off panic, carefully not thinking about whether the kids had died or about what Hammond would have to say when he found out. What finally made him move was the peculiar sensation he noticed in his mouth. The side of his mouth felt funny, kind of numb and tingling, and he wondered if he had hurt it during the fall. Regis touched his face and felt swollen flesh on the side of his mouth. It was funny, but it didn't hurt at all. Then he realized the swollen flesh was a leech, growing fat as it sucked his lips. It was practically in his mouth. Shivering with nausea, Regis pulled the leech away, feeling a tear from the flesh of his lips, feeling the gush of warm blood in his mouth. He spat and flung it with disgust into the forest. He saw another leech on his forearm and pulled it off, leaving a dark, bloody streak behind. Jesus, he was probably covered with them. That fall down the hillside, these jungle hills were full of leeches.
So were the dark, rocky crevices. What did the workmen say? The leeches crawled up your underwear. They liked dark, warm places. They liked to crawl right up your... Hello? He stopped. It was a voice carried by the wind. Hello, Dr. Grant!
Jesus, that was the little girl.
Ed Regis listened to the tone of her voice. She didn't sound frightened or in pain. She was just calling in her insistent way. And it slowly dawned on him that something else must have happened. That the Tyrannosaur must have gone away, or at least hadn't attacked. And that the other people might still be alive. Grant and Malcolm, everybody might be alive. And the realization made him pull himself together in an instant, the way you got sober in an instant when the cops pulled you over. And he felt better, because now he knew what he had to do. And as he crawled out from the boulders, he was already formulating the next step, already figuring out what he would say, how to handle things from this point. Regis wiped the cold mud off his face and hands, the evidence that he had been hiding. He wasn't embarrassed that he had been hiding, but now he had to take charge. He scrambled back up toward the road, but when he emerged from the foliage, he had a moment of disorientation. He didn't see the cars at all. He was somehow at the bottom of the hill. The Land Cruisers must be at the top. He started walking up the hill, back toward the Land Cruisers. It was very quiet. His feet splashed in the muddy puddles. He couldn't hear the little girl anymore. Why had she stopped calling? As he walked, he began to think that maybe something had happened to her. In that case, he shouldn't walk back there. Maybe the Tyrannosaur was still hanging around. Here he was, already at the bottom of the hill, that much closer to home. And it was so quiet. Spooky, it was so quiet. Ed Regis turned around and started walking back toward the camp. Alan Grant ran his hands over her limbs, squeezing the arms and legs briefly. She didn't seem to have any pain. It was amazing. Aside from a cut on her head, she was fine.
I told you I was, she said.
Well, I had to check. The boy was not quite so fortunate. Tim's nose was swollen and painful. Grant suspected it was broken. His right shoulder was badly bruised and swollen, but his leg seemed to be all right. Both kids could walk, that was the important thing. Grant himself was all right, except for a claw abrasion down his right chest where the Tyrannosaur had kicked him. It burned with every breath, but it didn't seem to be serious, and it didn't limit his movement. He wondered if he had been knocked unconscious because he had only dim recollections of events immediately preceding the moment he had sat up, groaning, in the woods, 10 yards from the Land Cruiser. At first, his chest had been bleeding, so he had stuck leaves on the wound, and after a while, it clotted. Then he had started walking around looking for Malcolm and the kids. Grant couldn't believe he was still alive, and as scattered images began to come back to him, he tried to make sense of them. The Tyrannosaur should have killed them all, easily. Why hadn't it?
I'm hungry,
Lex said. Me too, Grant said. We've got to get ourselves back to civilization, and we've got to tell them about the ship.
We're the only ones who know, Tim said.
Yes, we've got to get back and tell them.
Then let's walk down the road toward the hotel, Tim said, pointing down the hill. That way we'll meet them when they come for us.
Grant considered that, and he kept thinking about one thing, the dark shape that had crossed between the Land Cruisers even before the attack started. What animal had that been? He could think of only one possibility, the little Tyrannosaur.
I don't think so, Tim. The road has high fences on both sides, Grant said. If one of the Tyrannosaurs is further down on the road, we'll be trapped.
Then should we wait here? Tim said.
Yes, Grant said. Let's just wait here until someone comes.
I'm hungry,
Lex said. I hope it won't be very long, Grant said.
I don't want to stay here, Lex said.
Then, from the bottom of the hill, they heard the sound of a man coughing.
Stay here, Grant said.
He ran forward to look down the hill.
Stay here, Tim said, and he ran forward after him.
Lex followed her brother.
Don't leave me! Don't leave me here, you guys!
Grant clapped his hand over her mouth. She struggled to protest. He shook his head and pointed over the hill for her to look.
At the bottom of the hill, Grant saw Ed Regis standing rigid, unmoving. The forest around them had become deadly silent. The steady background drone of cicadas and frogs had ceased abruptly. There was only the faint rustle of leaves and the whine of the wind. Lex started to speak, but Grant pulled her against the trunk of the nearest tree, ducking down among the heavy, gnarled roots at the base. Tim came in right after them. Grant put his hands to his lips, signaling them to be quiet, and then he slowly looked around the tree. The road below was dark, and as the branches of the big trees moved in the wind, the moonlight filtering through made a dappled shifting pattern. Ed Regis was gone. It took Grant a moment to locate him. The publicist was pressed up against the trunk of a big tree, hugging it. Regis wasn't moving at all. The forest remained silent. Lex tugged impatiently at Grant's shirt. She wanted to know what was happening. Then from somewhere very near, they heard a soft snorting exhalation, hardly louder than the wind. Lex heard it too, because she stopped struggling. The sound floated toward them again, soft as a sigh. Grant thought it was almost like the breathing of a horse. Grant looked at Regis and saw the moving shadows cast by the moonlight on the trunk of the tree. And then Grant realized there was another shadow, superimposed on the others, but not moving. A strong, curved neck and a square head. The exhalation came again. Tim leaned forward cautiously to look. Lex did too. They heard a crack as a branch broke, and into the path stepped a tyrannosaur. It was the juvenile, about 8 feet tall, and it moved with the clumsy gait of a young animal, almost like a puppy. The juvenile tyrannosaur shuffled down the path, stopping with every step to sniff the air before moving on. It passed the tree where Regis was hiding and gave no indication that it had seen him. Grant saw Regis's body relax slightly. Regis turned his head, trying to watch the tyrannosaur on the far side of the tree. The tyrannosaur was now out of view down the road. Regis started to relax, releasing his grip on the tree. But the jungle remained silent. Regis remained close to the tree trunk for another half minute. Then the sounds of the forest returned. The first tentative croak of a tree frog, the buzz of one cicada, and then the full chorus. Regis stepped away from the tree, shaking his shoulders, releasing the tension. He walked into the middle of the road, looking in the direction of the departed tyrannosaur. The attack came from the left. The juvenile roared as it swung its head forward, knocking Regis flat to the ground. He yelled and scrambled to his feet, but the tyrannosaur pounced, and it must have pinned him with its hind leg because suddenly Regis wasn't moving. He was sitting up in the path, shouting at the dinosaur and waving his hands at it as if he could scare it off. The young dinosaur seemed perplexed by the sounds and movement coming from its tiny prey. The juvenile bent its head over, sniffing curiously, and Regis pounded on the snout with his fists. "Get away! Back off! Go on, back off!" Regis was shouting at the top of his lungs, and the dinosaur backed away, allowing Regis to get to his feet. Regis was shouting, "Yeah, you heard me! Back off! Get away!" as he moved away from the dinosaur. The juvenile continued to stare curiously at the odd, noisy little animal before it, but when Regis had gone a few paces, it lunged and knocked him down again. "It's playing with him," Grant thought. "Hey!" Regis shouted as he fell. But the juvenile did not pursue him, allowing him to get to his feet. He jumped to his feet and continued backing away. "You stupid! Back! Back! You heard me! Back!" he shouted like a lion tamer. The juvenile roared, but it did not attack. And Regis now edged toward the trees and high foliage to the right. In another few steps, he would be in hiding. "Back, you! Back!" Regis shouted. And then, at the last moment, the juvenile pounced and knocked Regis flat on his back. "Cut that out!" Regis yelled. And the juvenile ducked his head, and Regis began to scream. No words, just a high-pitched scream. The scream cut off abruptly. And when the juvenile lifted his head, Grant saw ragged flesh in his jaws.
"Oh, no,"
Lex said softly. Beside her, Tim had turned away, suddenly nauseated. His night vision goggles slipped from his forehead and landed on the ground with a metallic clink.
The juvenile's head snapped up, and it looked toward the top of the hill. Tim picked up his goggles as Grant grabbed both the children's hands and began to run.
Control. In the night, the compies scurried along the side of the road. Harding's jeep followed a short distance behind. Ellie pointed farther up the road.
Is that a light?
Could be, Harding said. Looks almost like headlights.
The radio suddenly hummed and crackled. They heard John Arnold say, "You there?" "Ah, there he is," Harding said, finally. He pressed the button. "Yes, John, we're here. We're near the river, following the compies. It's quite interesting."
More crackling.
Then, "Eat your cart!"
"What did he say?" Gennaro said. "Something about a car," Ellie said.
At Grant's dig in Montana, Ellie was the one who operated the radio phone. After years of experience, she'd become skilled at picking up garbled transmissions.
"I think he said he needs your car."
Harding pressed the button. "John, are you there? We can't read you very well. John?"
There was a flash of lightning, followed by a long sizzle of radio static. Then Arnold's tense voice.
"Where are... ooh! We're 1 mile north of the Hipsey paddock, near the river, following some compies." "No! Damn well! Get back here! Ow!"
"Sounds like he's got a problem," Ellie said, frowning. There was no mistaking the tension in the voice. "Maybe we should go back."
Harding shrugged. "John's frequently got a problem. You know how engineers are. They want everything to go by the book."
He pressed the button on the radio.
"John, say again, please."
More crackling. More static. The loud crash of lightning. Then,
"Muldoon, need your car. Ow!"
Gennaro frowned.
"Is he saying Muldoon needs our car?"
"That's what it sounded like," Ellie said.
"Well, that doesn't make any sense," Harding said. "Other stuck. Muldoon wants car."
"I get it," Ellie said. "The other cars are stuck on the road in the storm, and Muldoon wants to go get them."
Harding shrugged.
"Why doesn't Muldoon take the other car?"
He pushed the radio button.
"John, tell Muldoon to take the other car. It's in the garage."
The radio crackled.
"Not listen, crazy bastards! Car!"
Harding pressed the radio button.
"I said it's in the garage, John. The car is in the garage."
More static.
"Edry has... sing... won."
"I'm afraid this isn't getting us anywhere," Harding said.
"All right, John, we're coming in now."
He turned the radio off and turned the car around.
"I just wish I understood what the urgency is."
Harding put the jeep in gear, and they rumbled down the road in the darkness. It was another 10 minutes before they saw the welcoming lights of the safari lodge, and as Harding pulled to a stop in front of the visitor center, they saw Muldoon coming toward them. He was shouting and waving his arms.
"God damn it, Arnold, you son of a bitch! God damn it, get this park back on track! Now! Get my grandkids back here, now!"
John Hammond stood in the control room screaming and stamping his little feet. He had been carrying on this way for the last 2 minutes, while Henry Wu stood in the corner looking stunned.
"Well, Mr. Hammond," Arnold said, "Muldoon's on his way out right now to do exactly that."
Arnold turned away and lit another cigarette.
Hammond was like every other management guy Arnold had ever seen. Whether it was Disney or the Navy, management guys always behaved the same. They never understood the technical issues. And they thought that screaming was the way to make things happen. And maybe it was, if you were shouting at your secretaries to get you a limousine. But screaming didn't make any difference at all to the problems that Arnold now faced. The computer didn't care if it was screamed at. The power network didn't care if it was screamed at.
Technical systems were completely indifferent to all this explosive human emotion. If anything, screaming was counterproductive because Arnold now faced the virtual certainty that Nedry wasn't coming back, which meant that Arnold himself had to go into the computer code and try to figure out what had gone wrong. It was going to be a painstaking job. He'd need to be calm and careful.
"Why don't you go downstairs to the cafeteria," Arnold said, "and get a cup of coffee. We'll call you when we have more news." "I don't want a Malcolm effect here," Hammond said.
"Don't worry about a Malcolm effect," Arnold said.
"Will you let me go to work?" "God
Damn you,
Hammond said. I'll call you, sir, when I have news from Muldoon, Arnold said. He pushed buttons on his console and saw the familiar control screens change. Stroke Jurassic Park main module stroke. Stroke call libs. Include biostat.sys. Include sysrom.vst. Include net.sys. Include power.module. Stroke initialize. Arnold was no longer operating the computer. He had now gone behind the scenes to look at the code, the line-by-line instructions that told the computer how to behave. Arnold was unhappily aware that the complete Jurassic Park program contained more than 500,000 lines of code, most of it undocumented, without explanation. Wu came forward. What are you doing, John?
Checking the code.
By inspection? That'll take forever. Tell me, Arnold said. Tell me. The road. Muldoon took the curve very fast, the jeep sliding on the mud. Sitting beside him, Gennaro clenched his fists. They were racing along the cliff road, high above the river, now hidden below them in darkness. Muldoon accelerated forward, his face was tense. How much farther? Gennaro said.
2, maybe 3 miles.
Ellie and Harding were back at the visitor center. Gennaro had offered to accompany Muldoon. The car swerved.
It's been an hour, Muldoon said, an hour, with no word from the other cars.
But they have radios, Gennaro said.
We haven't been able to raise them, Muldoon said.
Gennaro frowned.
If I was sitting in a car for an hour in the rain, I'd sure try to use the radio to call for somebody.
So would I, Muldoon said. Gennaro shook his head. You really think something could have happened to them?
Chances are, Muldoon said, that they're perfectly fine, but I'll be happier when I finally see them. Should be any minute now.
The road curved, then ran up a hill. At the base of the hill, Gennaro saw something white lying among the ferns by the side of the road. Hold it, Gennaro said, and Muldoon braked. Gennaro jumped out and ran forward in the headlights of the jeep to see what it was. It looked like a piece of clothing, but there was... Gennaro stopped. Even from 6 feet away, he could see clearly what it was. He walked forward more slowly.
Muldoon leaned out of the car and said, What is it?
It's a leg, Gennaro said. The flesh of the leg was pale blue-white, terminating in a jagged, bloody stump where the knee had been. Below the calf, he saw a white sock and a brown slip-on shoe. It was a kind of shoe Ed Regis had been wearing. By then, Muldoon was out of the car, running past him to crouch over the leg.
Jesus!
He lifted the leg out of the foliage, raising it into the light of the headlamps, and blood from the stump gushed down over his hand. Gennaro was still 3 feet away. He quickly bent over, put his hands on his knees, squeezed his eyes shut, and breathed deeply, trying not to be sick.
Gennaro!
Muldoon's voice was sharp.
What? Move! You're blocking the light!
Gennaro took a breath and moved. When he opened his eyes, he saw Muldoon peering critically at the stump.
Torn at the joint line, Muldoon said. Didn't bite it, twisted and ripped it. Just ripped his leg off.
Muldoon stood up, holding the severed leg upside down, so the remaining blood dripped onto the ferns. His bloody hands smudged the white sock as he gripped the ankle. Gennaro felt sick again.
No question what happened, Muldoon was saying. The T-Rex got him.
Muldoon looked up the hill, then back to Gennaro.
You all right? Can you go on?
Yes,
Gennaro said. I can go on.
Muldoon was walking back toward the jeep, carrying the leg.
I guess we better bring this along, he said. Doesn't seem right to leave it here. Christ, it's going to make a mess of the car. See if there's anything in the back, will you? A tarp or newspaper?
Gennaro opened the back door and rummaged around in the space behind the rear seat. He felt grateful to think about something else for a moment. The problem of how to wrap the severed leg expanded to fill his mind, crowding out all other thoughts. He found a canvas bag with a tool kit, a wheel rim, a cardboard box, and 2 tarps, he said. They were neatly folded plastic.
Give me one, Muldoon said, still standing outside the car.
Muldoon wrapped the leg and passed the now shapeless bundle to Gennaro. Holding it in his hand, Gennaro was surprised at how heavy it felt.
Just put it in the back, Muldoon said. If there's a way to wedge it, you know, so it doesn't roll around. Okay, Gennaro put the bundle in the back, and Muldoon got behind the wheel. He accelerated, the wheels spinning in the mud, then digging in. The jeep rushed up the hill, and for a moment at the top, the headlights still pointed upward into the foliage, and then they swung down, and Gennaro could see the road before them. Jesus, Muldoon said. Gennaro saw a single Land Cruiser lying on its side in the center of the road. He couldn't see the second Land Cruiser at all. Where's the other car? Muldoon looked around briefly, pointed to the left. There! The second Land Cruiser was 20 feet away, crumpled at the foot of a tree. What's it doing there?
The T-Rex threw it.
Threw it? Gennaro said. Muldoon's face was grim.
Let's get this over with, he said, climbing out of the jeep.
They hurried forward to the second Land Cruiser. Their flashlights swung back and forth in the night. As they came closer, Gennaro saw how battered the car was. He was careful to let Muldoon look inside first.
I wouldn't worry, Muldoon said. It's very unlikely we'll find anyone.
No?
No, he said.
He explained that during his years in Africa, he had visited the scenes of a half dozen animal attacks on humans in the bush. One leopard attack, the leopard had torn open a tent in the night and taken a 3-year-old child. Then one buffalo attack in Amboseli. 2 lion attacks, 1 croc attack in the north near...